From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
Hello, Megan Mack.
Hello.
It's been a bit of a dreary, sad week. First day of snow of the year. Oh, it's only October.
It's sad when you have to brush off your car before Halloween.
Actually, I tell a story. It was a couple Halloweens ago. I was driving back from Connecticut and ran into 29 inches of snow in the Berkshires.
Oh, that's fun.
Before Halloween. Yeah. 29 inches. That was a lot. It was 4 inches of snow an hour driving through on the thruway. That was the most white knuckle I've ever felt.
So, I remember wearing snow pants going out trick-or-treating when we were kids.
Well, that's sort
it's
of
depressing.
Common. That's sort of common. But let's get to some interesting things. It has been a very interesting week on the show, and I think we should start with a conversation that surprised us in many ways. And I guess you can sum it up with a question. Why do we seem to look down upon jobs that leave our hands or clothes dirty?
Here's the backdrop. The Landmark Society of Western New York just released their annual list of five to revive. They chose buildings or complexes or historic places that need some love and attention. The hope is to get both grassroots efforts and some governmental assistance. But this year, their fifth and final item on the five to revive list was not a place. It was the traditional trades, jobs like carpentry, masonry, and repair work.
Yeah, and our listeners had a lot to say about this. So did our panel. You're going to hear from Steve Jordan, a longtime craftsman who has worked in window repair. You'll also hear Larry Francer and Wayne Goodman from the Landmark Society.
It does surprise me, and I don't really understand it, but I grew up working hard, and I don't find a lot of people willing to work in the trades. I think, unfortunately, they feel like it's a lesser path to success, or that people will look down on you, or you know, you walk around, you're dirty all day, and they're embarrassed about that sort of thing. But, you know, they need to get over it.
But there also has to be incentive to the craftspeople to take on these new young
That's a
people.
Good point, Larry, yeah. That's a problem.
And Evan, right. I think also part of the issue is, you know, if I can think back to the days when I was undergoing my sort of high school training, and, you know, that's getting harder and harder to remember. But it was really set up that if you're interested in the trades, then you're something less than those who are on a college-bound track. Mm-hmm. And I just find that to be remarkable in that Steve points out that there's a lot of chemistry involved. There's a lot of science involved with compounds and masonry and so forth and the design. So I think we have to send a message that young people who are interested in the traditional trades and these very sort of niche markets have to be very highly skilled individuals. It's not a lesser sort of avenue. Mike Rowe, who did, you know, Dirty Jobs on CNN,
Listening to Mike Rowe to Steve.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of Mike Rowe in that comment there. But Mike Rowe does make that point often, that, you know, we are hurting our own economy and our own society if we look down our noses at people whose good-paying jobs involve getting their clothes dirty.
This list of wages for the building trades all runs in the $40, $50, and $60 an hour, okay? Not everyone would expect to make that, and that's the kind of money someone might make working for themselves. However, it's not uncommon for people working in the trades around here for someone else to make $20, $25 an hour if they're highly skilled. That's a great wage compared to working at the mall.
We'll have to see if there are new training programs coming to Western New York to support more careers in the traditional trades.
All right, next let's turn our attention to a question raised by a Christian author and theologian. Does God want Christians to vote for Donald Trump? Eric Metaxas says yes. He wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal in which he argues that Hillary Clinton is the far worst choice in the eyes of God, and that God will not hold Christians blameless if they don't help elect Trump. Here's what Metaxas said about this in reference to abortion. He's talking about Christians who waver on supporting Trump and the impact on the unborn.
You're going to have the blood of those children on your hands.
But our panel and our listeners demonstrated that many, many Christians disagree with Eric Metaxas. In this clip, you'll hear from Pastor David Ryder of the New Flower City Church in Rochester. Then you'll hear Pastor Deb Swift of the South Presbyterian Church.
You used the word cop-out from it, that Metaxas said the word cop-out. You recapped that a minute ago, and he did. In his follow-up tweet, he actually said voting for a third-party candidate was something like a fig leaf in the Garden of Eden, that God cannot be fooled by your attempts to cover. So I think that is crazy, I guess, for lack of a better word. and problematic. I'm not sure I agree that we even have an obligation to vote at all as mm-hmm. Christians. So I don't agree with him that it's a cop-out or that God will hold us guiltless for the political situation in the U.S. And I'm not sure that voting for a candidate who doesn't represent Christian values, that Christians abstaining from the vote or voting for third-party candidates should be described as copping out in mm-hmm. any way. So I think that's mm-hmm. that's kind of where I would start, is I'm not sure mm-hmm. about this obligation. If you read the Metaxas article, he starts with a notion that Christians should be voting for Donald Trump because of or because of their faith. But then he goes on to list all of his reasons for, that are supposed to support this premise. And it's a list of foreign policy mm-hmm. reasons mm-hmm. and domestic policy reasons and past mm-hmm. mistakes and character flaws of Clinton, even after he acknowledged
corruption.
Those of Trump. And I don't think Eric Metaxas is a foreign policy expert. I don't think he's an economist. I think he's a theologian. And so I think to call people not to compartmentalize their faith, to call people to allow their faith to speak into the decision process of whom they will vote for is important. And I think mm-hmm. every one of us would agree with that, mm-hmm. that we all have that duty and that job. But to take that next step and say, and therefore you must vote for this candidate, especially in light of just how flawed this candidate is, I'm not sure that he has a right to do that.
Not all churches, especially not all mainline churches, hold the same position that he describes on Roe v. Wade, for instance. There are denominations that don't, that recognize that it is a private matter between a woman and God. And so they don't take a stand against Roe v. Wade. And for him to portray that that is the Christian view speaks to what I was saying earlier, and that we've all been lumped in together. And for believers, that's really an untenable position. And I think that's what galls me the most about
does
him
it insult
and
you?
Others. It does insult me. And it frustrates me because from my faith tradition and study of Scripture and the original Greek and Hebrew and all of that, it's almost as if it's ignored in favor of a popular understanding of what people are going to say Jesus would have done. Well, I mean, let's be real here. He was a complex guy, this Jesus. We have certain things that he stood for, yes. And how we interpret those today, you know, he was all about applying them in his time and in his place. And that's why we have to study.
Well, now how about some good news? Investigative journalist David K. Johnston says he's crunched the numbers and finally wages are going up.
Not just at the top either. Johnston says wages are going up for just about all levels of American earners. Here he is explaining.
First thing I want reporters to do is to get off this narrative there's no wage growth. And I'm the guy, probably more than anybody else in America when I was at the New York Times, who got this out on the front page year after year after year showing what was happening. It's changed now. We've made a turn, a big turn. And we need to recognize that we've made a big turn and start acknowledging that. The median wage and the average wage grew in 2013. The rate of growth for the median, that's half make more, half make less, tripled in 2014. And it more than tripled again in 2015. Now, from 2000 through 2014, even with those 2 years of increases in 2013 and 14, the total wage growth in 2014 compared to the year 2000 was $6 a year for the median, the middle point, $6 a year. In 2015, it went up $1,074. And the last 3 years combined come to over $1,500 or more than 5%. When we see the data for 2016, it's going to show even higher figures and continued growth. We're seeing the number of jobs grow. We've had 79 months of private sector job growth. That is unprecedented. The longest previous period was 52 months. 79 months of private sector job growth, 15.3 million jobs added. That's more than all of Europe and Canada combined. And they're not all bad-paying jobs either.
But you see, many people simply won't believe that wages are going up because they know the narrative, facts be damned, and that had us wondering, why do so many of us believe things that are obviously untrue, from conspiracy theories to basic sets of facts? Americans are capable of resisting new information.
So we sat down with Eric Kane, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
In my field, there's something called a fixed false belief. And we will occasionally see someone come in who's quite distressed, has no other evidence of psychosis or dysfunction, but has this firmly held belief. Now, they don't typically end up with a physician or a psychiatrist if it doesn't get in the way of their life. But if they think that a neighbor or another person is likely to harm them and they can't give it up, although, you know, they can go to work, they can do other things, they can take care of the house, they can drive the car, go shopping, then they may end up in my space, as it were. And it's extraordinarily difficult to help someone get over this. And it isn't necessarily susceptible to medicine either. And what you try to do is help restructure things so that someone doesn't get in the way of their lives or harm someone else. Now, the other thing that you see, though, is that people can hold almost two things simultaneously that are inconsistent with each other. One of the things in history that I always come back to is the World War I Christmas truce. Now, that was, you know, in the very beginning of World War I in 1914, and, you know, they had these battle lines, and they were killing each other and hating each other, and then they had a truce on Christmas.
And they sang
Christmas
Silent Night together.
Sang Silent Night together, shared gifts, ate food together, and then afterwards started killing each other again and hating each other. It's almost incomprehensible to me that people could do that, except it happened at a mass level. And was well documented and written about in a variety of ways. So there seemed to be the ability to hold in mind things that are seemingly impossible and contradictory. And it, to me, is at a cultural level, a social level, and an individual level. And it's rather striking that people can do this. The way you remove stereotypes or the way you remove false beliefs at times and people who are open to it is to bring them closer and closer to the person in question. To bring them, you know, have them see reality.
That's a great point.
Because
humanize the person.
Well, not only humanize, but actually take this anecdotal thinking that we use, that we can make something of, and take advantage of that so that he sees, as it were, with his own ears and eyes and see and hear with his own ears and eyes, the reality of the person, to take him away from the abstract. But it can be very difficult.
Let's close the week with a little fun, a parlor game of sorts. What do you think is the best television show of all time? Two longtime TV critics, Alan Sepinwall and Matt Zollerseitz, wrote a book to rank the top 100 shows. They created their own numerical formula, and their book is cleverly titled TV, The Book.
There was a 5-way tie for the top scoring show of all time, but they had to break the tie, and the critics chose The Simpsons for the top spot. Right behind it was The Sopranos, thanks in large part to scenes like this one. Here's Tony Soprano responding to his therapist, who has just asked Tony if he thinks he's going to hell.
Hell? You've been listening to me? No. For the same reasons. We're soldiers, you know. Soldiers don't go to hell. It's war. Soldiers, they kill other soldiers. We're in a situation where everybody involved knows the stakes. And if you're going to accept those stakes, you got to do certain things. It's business. We're soldiers.
But Wade, what about the controversial series ending for The Sopranos? Here's Matt Zollerseitz on what made that show great.
There were the dream sequences and all the stuff about the psychology of Tony, and you get into this sort of classic Freudian analysis of his issues and the question of whether or not people can truly change, and if so, how hard is it for them to change? And I think the show's conclusion is it's damn near impossible because as a species, we tend to be pretty lazy, you know? And then there was the end. I think the ending of The Sopranos is the greatest ending in the history of television. And the mere fact that when I say that online, I immediately get people running in to A, argue with me about it, because they hate that ending. They hate it. Or B, to insist that Tony died.
Does it matter to you?
I call them Tony Dies Truthers.
Tony Dies Truthers. But Matt, first of all, you're saying Tony didn't die. And second of all, does it matter that we know one way or another?
My position on the ending of that show is we don't know what happened. Although I have some problems with it from a filmmaking perspective, because I don't think the filmmaking in that final sequence supports that thesis, because there's too many bits of information that people cite as proof that it's all from Tony's perspective that are actually things that he had no way of knowing or seeing. And also the fact that by the time we get to that finale, all of the immediate physical threats to Tony and his mob family and his real family had been eliminated. So who's going to whack Tony at that point? Nobody. I mean, my interpretation of it is that it's more about Tony having won, quote unquote won, but basically being a prisoner. He's kind of stuck in a hell on earth of his own devising, and he doesn't know when that bullet is going to come. But also, I think that cut to black is basically David Chase whacking the viewer.
That's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can join us for Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a lovely weekend, and we will talk with you on Monday afternoon.